1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, we visit with Ian Gillan and Roger Glover as Deep Purple is inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
The album that launched Purple in the rest of the world was Deep Purple in Rock, which for some reason didn't, in the early days, capture the imagination of the American public. But I think through our live appearances later on, people kind of thought, well, what was this album? And in between that, we had an album called Fireball, which I thought was a vitally important album, creatively.
Started finally to make a bit of money. It was actually not until Fireball that we actually started, you know, we were paying back debts up until the end of Fireball.
Hi, this is Ian Gillan of Deep Purple in the studio.
Hello, I'm Roger Glover of Deep Purple, and I am in the studio talking to Redbeard.
The first time that I heard Deep Purple exploding out of a car dashboard speaker in 1968 with the cover of Joe South's song Hush, I had no way of knowing that I was hearing the primordial hard rock bellow of what would later evolve into heavy metal. Long credited along with Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath as the holy trinity of British hard rock, Deep Purple made three albums before acquiring lead singer Ian Gillan and bass player Roger Glover to join band co-founders Ritchie Blackmore on guitar, John Lord on the heavy Hammond organ, and proto-metal drummer Ian Paice. This lineup, first outing in 1970, called Deep Purple in Rock, blazed unlike anything before and precious little ever since. Miraculously, Gillan, Glover, and Paice still anchor Deep Purple to this day as a world-touring and recording band, seemingly defying all the odds. I asked Deep Purple's Roger Glover if he was surprised at the undying loyalty of their fans.
Well, it certainly pleases me. I don't know if that surprises me. It does to a certain extent, but I think it's justified our decision.
Oh, right. Sure.
I never, you know, when you're watching TV and you get the scrolls of the oldies come up,
uh-huh.
You know, buy the four albums of all the oldies, hits of the 50s
right.
and the 60s.
Right.
I never, ever want to be part of that. I never want to be in a band that's stuck to a time period.
Very good.
It's difficult to get away from it, but I think I feel very lucky that we have our era, sure. But I think if we'd have gone out as a kind of a period act, you know, listen to what rock was like in the 70s, you know, I would never have been part of that. And why there's such a commitment in this band to living and breathing now and progressing now, as opposed to just revamping what we've done.
And partying.
And, well, partying, we partied then too. And look what it did for us.
Sweet child in time, you'll see the line that's drawn between good and bad. See the blind man shooting at the world. Bullets flying, taking toll. If you've been bad, oh bet you have, and you've not been hit by a flying lead. You'd better close your eyes. Oh, bow your head. Wait for the ricochet. Ooh.
Stunned the rock world on 1970s Deep Purple in Rock with the epic song Child in Time, as well as Sonic Assault's Speed King. Here's Deep Purple lead singer Ian Gillan.
The album that launched Purple in the rest of the world was Deep Purple in Rock,
right?
Which for some reason didn't in the early days capture the imagination of the American public, but I think through our live appearances later on people kind of thought, well, what was this album? And in between that, we had an album called Fireball, which I thought was a vitally important album, creatively.
I try.
Strange Kind of Woman by Deep Purple from 1971's Fireball album is clearly a precursor to even stronger songwriting and tighter playing on the next album, Machine Head, coming up next. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard, in the studio with Deep Purple's Ian Gillan and Roger Glover for their long-awaited induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Hi, this is Ian Gillan of Deep Purple, in the studio.
Hello, I'm Roger Glover of Deep Purple, and I am in the studio, talking to Redbeard.
Thank you, gentlemen. The Deep Purple album that came out in 1972 called Machine Head cannot be overstated for its impact on the individuals in the band, nor hard rock in general. Of course, the irony of Deep Purple's Machine Head is that it ever was made at all, according to Deep Purple lead singer lyricist Ian Gillan.
I thought we did it in Christmas 71, because I'd just recovered from a severe bout of hepatitis. Mm. And I came from 2-3 months recuperation at home and just crawled out there to do this album. We flew into Montreux in Switzerland, and we went to watch, this is the famous part of it, we went to watch Frank Zappa show at the casino. This was the night before we were due to start recording there. And our mobile studio, the Rolling Stones mobile that we were renting, was parked outside. Claude Nobbs, who was the main man in Montreux, organises the jazz festival and everything else, had sorted us out. And we were staying at the Eden O'Lack Hotel just down the road. We turned up to see the Zappa show. We sat in some really nice seats right in front of the stage. And towards the end of the show, which was spectacular, I remember it to this day, because they had Flo and Eddie in the band at that time, and it was superb. And some guy came in with a flare gun, shot it into the roof. The whole thing caught fire. Everyone just panicked. Zappa was brilliant. Claude Nobbs was great. The people at the back, we were fortunate because we were in an area we could get out quite well. Everyone else just steamed through plate glass windows, God knows what. About 3,000 people, I guess, were in this auditorium. It was packed. It was that's a big auditorium in Switzerland. Claude went back into the place. We were all ushered out anyway because there was a gas station right adjacent to this old wooden casino, which was beautiful. And we were sitting in this kind of bar restaurant, which was overlooking the lake, Lake Geneva, and about maybe a quarter of a mile from the casino, which had really taken. The flames were going 200-300 feet in the air, and it was an inferno. And the wind was coming down off the mountains and blowing the flames and the smoke across the lake, and the smoke was just like a stage show. It was hanging on the water. Never forget, Roger grabbed a napkin and wrote down on this napkin, "Smoke on the water."
Records with a mobile.
Ritchie Blackmore provided one of the most famous guitar chord progressions since Chuck Berry on Machine Head. Deep Purple also created the seminal supercharged driving song Highway Star. Deep Purple lead singer Ian Gillan relives the musical motor first turning over.
That was written in a bus on the way to Portsmouth in England. I remember the day we wrote that. And Ritchie and myself, maybe Roger as well, were jamming away in these bus seats. He said, let's do something like ding, 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 ding. And we just started singing it. The words were different, but the essence of the song was there, Highway Star. We did it that night at Portsmouth Guildhall. That was the first ever performance of it. I mean, it was spontaneous lyrics and whatever, but that evolved into what it was on Machine Head. I mean, Highway Star is a classic. You know, I love doing that song now. I get shivers down my spine when I'm standing on the side of the stage and the guys go on and start down, you know, and you hear that, like the drums start, and then, it's incredible.
thunderous deep purple shifting through the gears of Highway Star, originally on Machine Head. With the definitive version coming from one of the greatest hard rock double live albums ever, called Made in Japan. You may be surprised to hear that it was initially not released by Deep Purple's American record label. Here's Roger Glover, followed by Ian Gillan.
Well, it wasn't the kind of done thing to do. Live right. albums were things that people did when they had nothing better to do. We said we weren't really interested, but they insisted. So we said, okay, you can do it as long as you contain it to Japan.
Right.
It doesn't get out anywhere else. And if it's, you know, if it's lousy, we get the right to say no.
Right.
And it was done on really rotten-looking equipment, and we really didn't have much faith in it until we got back to England. And we sat down in the studios and listened to it, and we were blown away with the quality. That's when we said, we want to put this out worldwide. And in fact, it was quite a fight to get it out worldwide then.
It's really interesting that when we first came into the States, we noticed, actually even before that, when we first became aware of American bands in England, the one staggering difference between the approach to stage performance and American bands and English bands was that they actually rehearsed, and they came with this sort of, you know, they knew what was coming next, and they knew what they were going to do, and they knew where the solos were and everything else. It was really incredible. And, of course, we never do.
Oh, come on now.
No, quite seriously. There is a framework for the song.
Roger, you're shaking your head.
I'm agreeing with you.
In agreement.
There's a framework for the songs insofar as the words are mostly the same most nights. And after a couple of verses in a chorus, generally there's a guitar solo. But you never really know quite what's going to happen. I don't think any two shows have been the same since we started.
As a matter of fact, I've got a bootleg of Highway Star where you're talking about Mickey Mouse.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, that was the original theme of the song.
We
Still to come, Deep Purple finds international success harder to handle than the struggle to get there, only to regroup in the latter half of the 80s with equal success. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net. I'm Redbeard with Deep Purple's Ian Gillan and Roger Glover in the studio for Deep Purple's induction into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Hi, this is Ian Gillan of Deep Purple in the studio.
Hello, I'm Roger Glover of Deep Purple, and I am in the studio talking to Redbeard.
Congratulations, guys. Well-deserved honor. Even though certain Deep Purple songs from the Machine Head era remain mandatory in the live set to this very day. Nevertheless, Roger Glover maintains that the songs from their latest releases, including the brilliant Now What album from 2013, it breathes new life into even the iconic songs, which are now standards.
If you're on the road for months and months and months and you're doing the same basic set, if you're that rehearsed, you're going to get so tired of it.
It's
going to be like going to a factory.
You're right.
You know, and putting the same little screw in the same little bolt.
You're right.
We purposely make it fairly spontaneous and free. As Ian said, there's a structure there.
Well, sure.
But there's got to be a bit of fun involved, and you don't get fun. You know, a joke's only good once. If you tell a joke twice, it's not funny. And the same, a musical joke's the same thing. A musical joke has to be spontaneous. And actually, that's the reason why when we make a record, we don't have all the songs worked out ahead of time. We write as we record. So the songs themselves are spontaneous to start with.
Ow!
Woman from Tokyo appeared on Machine Head's studio follow-up called Who Do We Think We Are? But it turns out that international success is not an antidote when you have the mercurial, moody Ritchie Blackmore in your band. Singer Ian Gillan split first, then Blackmore himself with Roger Glover in tow left to start Rainbow, and eventually John Lord and Ian Paice would augment Whitesnake after David Coverdale had sung on a couple of mid-70s Deep Purple albums. Fast forward 11 long years to 1985, and a secret meeting described here by Ian Gillan and then Roger Glover.
Roger, Ritchie, John, Ian Paice, myself. It had been on and off, this sort of thing, with regard to conversations and everything, for probably a couple of years. Everyone had their own thoughts on it.
I'm sure.
I was probably the most obviously and consistently enthusiastic for the previous 2 years to get it together. In fact, when it didn't happen the previous year, I decided to do a short spell with Black Sabbath because I had nothing to do. When I finished with them, I picked up the phone again, and I think Rainbow had sort of come to a fairly natural conclusion at that time. They didn't have anywhere obvious to go. I didn't, and nor did John and Ian, really, because the Whitesnake thing had sort of lost its thing for John. I didn't particularly want to form another band myself, and it seemed obvious, I think, to me, anyway, that we'd all been doing stuff which was good, but not as good as Deep Purple was, and that blend of personalities and characters was really the only band I ever wanted to be in again. So probably I pushed harder for the meeting than anyone else, but I think the only one thing that we all agreed on before the meeting was that if we were going to do it, it was going to be a permanent thing, and we were going to record an album and stay together for as long as we could foresee, you know, without working ourselves into the ground and breaking up and getting sick again and all that sort of thing. I know Roger had probably more reservations than anyone else.
I wasn't really too sure about where Deep Purple lay in the scheme of things, even at the time. I mean, I knew we were a successful band because we had records on the wall, but I didn't feel it emotionally. And I just felt like we were a band. We were proud of what we did, but I couldn't foresee it lasting longer than the next tour. The legend, I thought, grew bigger than the band ever was. And I thought, with something like that, with that kind of name, that really we should leave it alone, because if we got back together again, it'd be a gigantic anticlimax, and if it didn't work, it would be very embarrassing. So I was very worried of it, mainly for those reasons.
And their reaction to the audience's embrace of the multi-million selling Perfect Strangers reunion album in 1985?
This might sound weird, and I'm probably Deep Purple's greatest fan, so it didn't surprise me at all. I mean, I want to leap off stage and watch these guys playing most nights. Just want to get down in the audience and watch them and listen to them.
That's great.
The one thing that's actually has surprised me, and I think probably given more pleasure than anything else, is the fact that it's still got, after all these years, a sort of underground feeling to it. It's not a big hype thing. It's not a big commercial effort and everything else. It's professional in that sense, but it's not in any way been based upon those efforts. And I think that to just see the audience and the kind of audiences we're getting, and they're people who like music, you know, they're not people who just go just because they want to be part of a fashion parade or what's going on at the moment. They're people who care about what they listen to, and I get this from the people I talk to at the shows and everything. And it's nice to know that what started out as an underground band, really, in effectively 1969, is still an underground band.
We don't.
This is Redbeard in the studio congratulating my guests, Deep Purple's Ian Gillan and Roger Glover. In the Studio is written and produced by yours truly, Redbeard, for Bearded Fish Productions, copyright 2016, all rights reserved, transcription by Jane Carpenter Brunet, theme song by Andy Timmons. Follow In the Studio on Facebook, on Twitter, at Redbeard Rocks, and online at inthestudio.net.